Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Richard Campbell. Richard wrote his first line of code in 1977 and still isn't over it. Makes the podcasts .NET Rocks and Run As Radio, and is one of the folks behind Dev Intersection conferences, as well as being chief cheerleader for the charity Humanitarian Toolbox. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, guys. It's weird to be in the other seat. Normally, it's me doing all the banter off the top. So this is strange. Forgive me if I'm vaguely uncomfortable.
Awesome. Before we kind of get started, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself? Maybe how you kind of got started?
They wrote the first line of code in 1977 is absolutely true. It was in a Radio Shack. I was going in there to buy the parts for an electronic rocket countdown timer because I'm so lazy, I don't even want to say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I'm 10 years old. So, you know, I have a long history of being remarkably lazy. There was a TRS-80 Model 1 in the corner. And I found out later, having read on the history of that machine, that the Tandy Corporation did not believe in it, and so they basically made enough to put one in every store, and then were surprised when they sold. So 4K of memory in it, a cassette tape player to store the programs on it, 127x47 resolution graphics, and a version of BASIC that was not made by Microsoft. It was a tiny BASIC, and it only had 3 error messages: what, how, and sorry. Which is the best error message ever, right? Like, sorry is the perfect... What is object not found, but sorry? First line of code was 10 print hello world, right? And then 22nd line of code was 20 go to 10, and then I had to learn about the break key.
You just unplug it at that point, right?
Well, and then, of course, nobody in the store knew much about it. And here's this 10-year-old kid tinkering away, and eventually they figured out that I was a pretty good sales tool. It's like, if the 10-year-old kid can make it work, then why can't you? So I was just there every day. Like, that became, I went there after school and tinkered with the machine, and eventually saved up enough from the paper route to get myself my own machine. But my first real job after the paper route was at 12 years old repairing TRS-80s. I worked for a company called H&S Microsystems. My father's an electrical engineer. I'd soldered since I was 6 or 7. And so we were doing installations of lower case kits and adding memory and things to the TRS-80. So I've really not done anything else, just done it longer than most people. I've been in computing now over 40 years, for better or worse.
So a little weird question maybe, but I'm curious. Do you remember how much the TRS-80 cost you at 12?
$14.99. Canadian dollars.
Like $1,499?
$1,499, that's right. Yeah.
That's a lot of money for a 12-year-old.
It was a ton. It was a ton of money, but, you know, I was desperate. And then I was not working for H&S, so I did all the upgrades on the cheap and was able to keep it going, and eventually switched to an Apple II in the early 80s. And then the IBM PC. I remember reading the initial specifications on the 5370 on the original model and going, wow, whole mega RAM. I don't know the heck you're going to do with that much memory, but okay.
So what are you working on these days?
Well, the podcasts continue to do the thing, just 1,580 episodes of .NET Rocks. So we got to figure out what to do about 1,600, which is always a problem because... You know, get these 00 shows. I'm running out of celebrations. This will be the 16th one. I came on as co-host in 100. So I've been in every aught show. And Run As Radio, which is the IT half of my brain, we just hit 600.
Very nice.
Yeah, you know, every Wednesday since April 11th, 2007. If not persistent. And then the conferences, Dev Intersection, SQL Intersection, we've been making since 2012. Humanitarian Toolbox started around the same time and building open source software for disaster relief organizations. And then I got smitten with this stupid idea to write a book about the history of .NET, which I haven't hit the phase of absolutely hating it yet, but I understand there's no way to finish a book that doesn't get you to that phase. So I'm nowhere near finished, clearly.
You definitely, by the time it's you get about three quarters way in, you're just like, I just don't want to do it anymore.
No, kill me, right? the cool part about that particular book, not only that I was there, and let's face it, .NET Rocks was created to talk about .NET. Carl started it back in 2002 when .NET was brand new. And so we've got our own history in the sense of these nearly 1,600 episodes. But, and I've known a lot of the principals, guys like Scott Guthrie and Jason Zander and so forth, for more than 10 plus years. And I've had the, you know, you meet them at conferences. I've had dinners and things over the years. But to sit and talk to a guy like Scott Guthrie, literally for hours, to go through these stories and sort of remember and get him back into those times. When I first sat down with him, which is now almost a year ago, when I first sat down to start doing interviews because he's incredibly difficult to schedule, he produced his handwritten notebooks from 1997.
Wow.
He had them.
Wow.
With him. And I got the chance to look through them. A, the man's handwriting is beautiful. But I also felt like they were museum pieces. I'm like, Scott, you really have to actually turn this into like the Microsoft Museum. This is the original drawings of request and response.
this belongs like, in a museum.
Yeah, they're 20-year-old, you know, ring binder books, so they're turning yellow, and then there's I think they're very special, maybe only to me, but they felt important.
I'd love to see them.
Yeah, no, I think they should be protected. I think they should be in a like nitrogen bubble so they don't decay anymore. But that's personally just amazing, folks that I've known in all these years and to really get into some long conversations. Mads Torgensen actually called me the father confessor of .NET now because people are telling me some outrageous stories of the things. You know, it's 20 years of history.
So what was the catalyst for the book? Is this an idea that you've been kicking around for a while, or was there a certain event that said, you know?
There was a moment. Yeah, absolutely. In 2017. There was a party thrown in Redmond for the 15th anniversary of the shipping of .NET. And Beth Massey, who's the head of marketing for .NET at the time, contacted me, and I've known her for many years as well. And she just said, hey, the alumni, these ex-Microsoft employees, they have an organization, are going to put on this party. Did you want to be involved? And I'm like, sure. We sort of took a look at the list, and I kind of, you know, you remember all these people, you know, and I'm for better or worse, I'm a professional storyteller these days. So she asked me if I would do some Channel 9 bits. And you can find these on Channel 9 now, the happybirthday.net bits, which we recorded at this party. It was at a brew pub, so I was sort of on the brew side. Little 5-minute nuggets. But I found myself remembering stories and things that people had said and actually saying it back to them. I remember when you did, and they're like, wow. You know, the problem when you're an engineer, when you're like an Anders Hausberg, and you've worked on this stuff for years and years, you know, you don't remember necessarily what you talked about in 2000. But I did. So he laughed, and we talked through some different parts. And I came out of that thinking, you know, if we don't write this down soon, we're going to lose it. It's literally been 20 years. And my interviewing to gathering the research for knowing this in more detail, it's just reminded me over and over again. It's like a good call because it is fading from people's memories. And it's been, I feel like it's been very forensic that I am now sort of triangulating a meeting from three or four different people to have some confidence that they're remembering it correctly because it's so long ago.
Yeah, I was kind of maybe a late adopter to .NET. I got my start with classic ASP and VB6 and did a little bit of Java and a little bit of PHP and moved over into .NET and into VB.NET around 2.0, I think. Some of my friends and colleagues had started in .NET 1.0 and then the breaking changes to 1.1.
Right. And then more breaking changes in 2.0. Like I would argue 2.0 was not only the third version, which is hilarious because, you know, numbers are hard, but also that was the real manifestation of what they intended for .NET in the beginning. So arguably it gets harder from there. the next up will be the fallout of Vista.
Right.
After 2.0, right? 3.0 is basically an emergency version to catch WPF, WCF workflow and so forth. The CLR isn't revved. Like they do a bunch of things, and then they'll take them 2 years. That's 2006. And then by 2008 with 3.5, 3.5.1, you sort of get that next manifestation of .NET. And then we go into Windows 8. So things were wonderful after that.
What's been the most interesting story or most surprising story that you've collected along the way? Is there anything in particular that comes to mind?
And I do look at the story in three acts, sort of what happened before .NET shipped, that first manifestation 2002, 2005. Then you sort of the hard times or the dark times of Vista Win 8, Vista / Longhorn Win 8, although 2010 was a good version. And then that little period around Silverlight and so forth, I mean, those were very tough moments. And then so now this fourth act is what we're experiencing now with it becoming open source and actually disentangling itself from Windows. So how do you pick one story? One of the ones that I always get a laugh from that I've mentioned here and there is that when I've confirmed now that there's the apocryphal story of Guthrie taking on the next version of ASP. You know, he came in as a hire directly out of Duke University in 97 and worked on Studio 97 in the NT option pack. He was working on IIS4. And so he worked on ASP and he didn't like it much. But he had been told from the get-go, start thinking about what comes next. You know, like, you're the new guy, you've got your degree, you're big on object orientation, like, what do you want to do next? So they ship Studio 97 in November of 97. And as is normal, you take a couple of weeks off after you get a major version shipped. And then that was on top of Christmas. So for the most part, the studio team took December 97 off. Well, young Mr. Guthrie didn't want to do that. In fact, he didn't go back to North Carolina for Christmas either. I'm sure his mother was offended by that. He went skiing in Salt Lake City. That's the only thing he did. And he spent that month prototyping his idea of what would come after, what would be the ASP Plus is what he called it at the time. And he wanted the scripting language, the programming language. Well, he was writing in C, of course. I mean, it's important to remember that most Microsoft internal developers are actually C programmers. He wanted the scripting language to be object-oriented. Well, in 1997, Microsoft had exactly one truly object-oriented scripting language, and that was Java. their implementation of Java called J++. So the demonstration he did to the studio team in January of 98 of this new version, the scripting language was Java. And now, at that point, the lawsuit hadn't happened yet. It would come later in the next year, but he was already told at the time, yeah, you're going to have to move away from Java.
that's not going to fly.
No. I mean, the funny thing is, that if not for the Sun lawsuit, they probably would have continued using Java. J++ was wildly successful, like fabulously successful, but they were starting to optimize it for Windows, as you would. Right, Windows is the largest desktop operating system at the time by, you know, in the 90 plus percentile range. And so, of course, they're going to start optimizing, which was ultimately the basis of the lawsuit, is that they weren't necessarily following the standards of what Java should be. But until then, Microsoft had never made an original language. They always implemented other people's languages. That was the normal thing. They had their own implementation of C and C++. They had their own implementation of BASIC, several. And they had this implementation of Java that was doing very well for them. And only because Anders Hausberg wasn't allowed to work on Java anymore, they went, well, I could make something new. And they're like, go for it. What the heck? It takes them a few years, but, you know, they get there.
Yeah, and talking about the breaking changes from .NET 1.0 to 1.1 and to 2.0, mm-hmm. not necessarily breaking changes, but we're seeing sort of that similar evolution from .NET Core 1.0 to .NET Core 2.0 that it seems like a lot of the enterprise.
Remember that there was a Core 1.1.
Right, right.
So that by 2.0 they would have a third version because numbers are hard.
Right. But it seems like a lot of the enterprise people were waiting for that next major version to ship. And I think there was even an article in was it MSDN magazine by Julie Lerman that with EF Core 2.0 or 2.1, hell yes, it's ready for prime time or something similar to that effect. And I kind of get the sense that that goes with the entire .NET Core ecosystem.
Yeah. You know, I get obviously working on .NET Rocks, I get a lot of email and messages and things from a wide range of folks. And there's plenty of standard framework people that are still happy. And especially if you're building desktop apps, which the average enterprise guy, that's what they're building, right? Mm-hmm. If they're pure web-based, they can consider .NET Core. But if you're using WinForms, and tons of people are, or you've moved across to WPF and things, like there still is an answer for you in Core. You're living in standard for a reason. It'll be interesting to see what happens with 3, because they are going to this model now of it's still going to be Core, but you're going to have a new version of WinForms and a new version of WPF and some other bits and pieces that are specific to Windows. They're just a separate NuGet installation. So there's in sort of a Windows-centric UI SDK. The biggest thing in my mind that we're going to get from that you know, people should be excited about, and I talked about this with Scott Hunter at some point, I think it might have been actually a build, was that they had internally made a version of WinForms that dealt with high DPI screens, because regular WinForms doesn't. Bad things happen unless you go third-party. But it's fundamentally breaking changes. Like it just renders WinForms differently. And so they just weren't willing to ship it. If we do this to WinForms, we're going to break existing apps. And that's a mistake. So making a new WinForms package that is installed separately and works with Core is a way to make it very clear to everybody. Like, yes, it says WinForms and it will run your code, but you better check it because it's going to be different. And that to me is a really interesting answer to the problem. On DNR, we've talked repeatedly about this idea of until you get to a place where I can take an existing standard code base, pick it up, and put it down on Core and only get warnings. A lot of ass software is just not going to be touched. Why should it be? It's not broken. And Microsoft's never going to give up on the standard framework, right? For crying out loud, they still ship the VB6 runtime in Windows 10.
But how else are you going to work on your resume-driven development if you don't lift and shift those existing applications?
You know, one of the best things in resumes doesn't work on things that do nothing good for the company, right?
Right. Like,
apps that work are the best feature to look for in an app. And stuff works. And you're just taking, you know, you've really got to argue over the value proposition of migrating existing software. Rewrite, like, for a new purpose, for a new set of features. Hey, we want to get to mobile. Hey, this needs to function in the cloud. Okay, now we can talk. But, hey, move that onto the new framework because it's shiny. Like, that's never been a good idea.
Right, right. Our core business system is happily running in the background. Oh, let's go ahead and change all of that.
Right. We actually, you know, sitting down and collecting the stories of why Roslyn finally came to be, because the rewriting the C# compiler in C#, like that goal of you should be able to write your compiler in its own language, that's a very much a computer science mantra. Mm-hmm. But by the time Microsoft is talking seriously about doing that with C#, which is, you know, in the 2005 timeframe, there's so many people already depending on C#. It's the risk is too high. It's not worth it, right? There are people that are counting on unexpected behaviors inside of the C# compiler that's written in C++. And if you normally, you know, the polite, that's the polite description for what is a bug. If you fix those bugs, you break people's code. And so they went around in circles for many years about Roslyn just doesn't provide enough value. It got to the point where I started calling on the show Roslyn the fusion power of .NET. Like, it's just a few years away. Just a few more years away. Mads told this great story of the, you know, the transformative moment was that they realized they were writing C# twice. Every feature in C# had to be written twice. Once in the compiler, and once in IntelliSense, in the runtime space of Visual Studio, so that you could get the prompting and so forth. And it was finally getting expensive. The feature set was large enough that, and if you, heaven help you if you get that wrong, right? The compiler behaves one way and the studio behaves another. And so this, it was the the moment that they said, if we could do compiler as a service so it could work in both places, this justifies that cost. That suddenly, ta-da, we have the money and the energy and the split in the team and so forth to actually get Roslyn finished. It was not originally going to be cross-platform and open source. That came later. You know, they made good decisions. You don't do this because you want to write C# and C#. I mean, there's a huge upside for us as C# users that now the C# team programs in C# every day. Because up to 2013, they programmed in C++ every day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the reasons I think C# just went off like a gunshot after Roslyn is that you have these remarkable minds that now think C# every day.
Yeah, and I think it's really been interesting to see that now that they're more or less feature complete and they've got all the parity from full framework over to .NET Core, now they've been focusing on performance and they've gotten build times down significantly and they're you know, continuing to make these outstanding improvements to the language.
And it's parity only if you're a web developer.
Right. Right.
If you're a client-side developer, it's still, there's miles to go. And so it'll be interesting to see as the later versions come in, how much of that they can actually pick up. But one of the problems is that people use .NET for so many different things, and it's easy to forget. It's actually a huge problem for me in the book, is how much of this do I put in the book? You know, I could write three chapters on the mobile story alone, but if you're not a mobile dev, I don't know how interesting it actually is to you. Part of me is wondering if I should go down the build your own adventure path where it's like, tell me what things you care about. I'll generate you a book.
turn to chapter 23, page 5.
If you don't need to hear the pain of WinPhone 8, skip this chapter.
I'm so sad about Windows Phone.
Yeah, me too. It helped that WinPhone 10 wasn't that good.
I actually liked the platform.
I did, but I think it peaked at Win 8. At Phone 8, Phone 8 was the best version. They never really finished 10 because the team started coming apart and so forth. And so it had these rough edges and it made it easier to put it down. But, you know, I'm still live very much in a mobile world that says, well, what, you know, they all suck. Which suck can you live with?
I mean, I'm a developer. I can live with a lot of suck.
Yeah. You know, I actually was briefly happy in Cyanogen because, you know, deep down, I'm a masochist. But, you know, it's like, if you're gonna have a problem, make the entire problem your own. Cyanogen is that.
I can understand. I need to look into that because...
Well, it's gone now. Like when you were literally building your own OS for your phone, then it's like, you can't yell at anybody. Everything is your fault.
Oh, well, I'm doing that for the computer, so...
Yeah.
I'm still holding out hope for the rumor and the promise of a Surface phone in the distant future.
Well, apparently we're going to hear some kind of announcement in October, so it may not be that distant a future, right? They've had a save the date in New York. I know one of the rumors is a dual screen folding phone. So
unfortunately though, I bought the watch. They killed it.
The Spot watch?
I bought the phone. I bought every version of the phone. I bought every version of the band,
the Microsoft band.
The band, yeah. The Microsoft band.
Loved my band. My band is still sitting off camera over here. Yeah, and it's in a little shrine, you know, shrouded in black.
Yeah, but how many broken wristbands do you have?
All of them.
I bought the band 1. I bought the band 2. I bought Windows Phone 7, Windows Phone 8, Windows Phone 10. And they just killed everything that I was buying. So like, say they come out with a Surface phone, even though I want to, I'm not sure I can invest.
Well, I prefer that you didn't, because clearly you're the reason all those products died. So I blame Clayton from now on.
And you boycotted Google because they killed Reader.
I did. For 2 years. Why did they kill Reader?
I went wristless, deviceless for a long time after the band. My last band died and they couldn't replace it. I finally put a Fitbit back on, but, you know, it took a while. So nothing but sorrow. That's what it is.
Just heartache and pain.
I don't, you know, you mentioned Silverlight. I'm not sure how I'm going to write about Silverlight. It's an interesting problem.
Yeah, would you talk about that a little bit?
You know, I mean, Silverlight never actually died, right? I mean, you could still build stuff in Silverlight if you want.
A seller.
You pretty much got to run it in IE these days, and that's not a seller either, is it? But they got into this really weird state where the actual crisis of Silverlight happens when the iPad ships. And so when the, you know, they put out Studio 2010 in April of 2010, and it's got Silverlight 3 in it, which is the big version. Like, then, you know, we're all enamored and in love and things are awesome and it runs out of the browser and it works beautifully on the Mac. And the same month they produce the iPad, and the next month in May, Jobs puts out this letter in the New York Times called Thoughts on Flash.
Apple bricks plugins.
Yeah, well, and he justified it very, very well, right? This is a vector for malware, and you know, it defeats the whole whitelist model of the store and so forth. But the reality was Flash was murdering the iPad's battery.
Mm-hmm.
And you could circumvent it at the time, right? There was a third-party browser you could put in that would allow Flash to run, and it did murder the iPads. You know, one would argue if Flash hadn't sucked so much, this wouldn't have happened. But yeah, but the moment that plugin is dead, Silverlight is dead man walking. We just don't know, right? That's if you're not paying attention to those things and actually thinking through the consequences, you're unaware that we're hooped. It's off iOS and it's never going to be on iOS, and that's all there is to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last PDC, and there's not a lot of, the other thing that happened with the Silverlight team is that a lot of them had moved over to phone. WinPhone 7 and was largely a derivative of Silverlight.
Mm-hmm.
And so the team's already split, and the crisis, you know, we may not have reacted strongly to the iPad in the .NET community, but internally to Microsoft, they did. You know, this is the beginning of the Win 8 crisis that we need to tackle the tablet head on. And so they're looking at that problem space and what that looks like, knowing Silverlight isn't going to run everywhere. And so there's not a lot of content at the PDC in 2010 about Silverlight. And then Mary Jo Foley asked Bob Muglia, hey, what's up with Silverlight? And that's when you get that famous quote, our strategy has shifted.
Mm.
And it was others that spun it into Silverlight is dead. But because of the way this team was scattered so forth, like there was literally nobody to answer the concern. And at the same time, Microsoft is coming out of, is headed into, we've got to surprise everybody with Win 8. And so they're starting to keep secrets again, and they don't want to talk about that stuff. And so nobody has a voice. They're muzzled right at the moment. I think it's why people are still so angry about Silverlight, is that we were essentially left hanging.
Mm-hmm.
And here I'm making a show called .NET Rocks in the midst of all of this. You know, then I go to the first Build conference in 2011, and Carl and I walked out of that conference and went, what if .NET doesn't rock? So if you go back and look, you'll see we set up a new podcast. We set up the Tablet Show in 2011. That was our backup strategy. Plus, it was really hard to figure out where iOS and Android was going to play in the ecosystem, like how any of that worked. And so here's a place to put that stuff. And if it really goes badly, and we know now it didn't, we have an alternative. And so when, for a while there, we're making a lot of shows. But by 2014, we turned the corner and .NET clearly rocked. And the Tablet Show was getting harder and harder for me to figure out what goes on the Tablet Show versus what goes on .NET. Because you didn't realize the other thing that happened in 2011 was that Miguel Diakaza ships Mono for Android. He'd already had Mono Touch, but it's like literally at the same moment that Microsoft is selling us WinJS because JavaScript's the only language that's going to work everywhere, in wanders Miguel Diakaza with us. So you like C# on the iPhone? I can do that. How about we do it on Android too? Well, he had this moment, you know, and by the way, at that same time, Andrews has moved over to start working on what would become TypeScript. So, you know, there was you can go back and listen to the shows in 2011, 2012, where we're talking about, I think the current godfather of C# is Miguel Diakaza. You know, that there was a moment there where that was the true believer. And, you know, of course, by the end of 2012, Win 8 ships. It is not exactly a wild hit. The only thing less popular than that was WinJS. and the vast majority of the apps in the App Store for Win 8 are C# XAML.
Can you even do WinJS still in Windows 10? Yes. You can?
And it's an open source library now, too, and part of the .NET Foundation. And it's my one place that I can, you know, Microsoft has been very diligent about, we don't dump software onto open source. And I sort of poke at WinJS and go, are you sure? Well, and we have had an opportunity to interview a couple of guys that are like are the maintenance guys that do the maintenance stuff. And I'm sure there's a maintainer who's responsible if there's security violation or risks or anything like that would deal with all of that. So, but not a lot of activity on the WinJS library. You should go take a peek. It's there. It's all out in public.
Well, very fascinating. One of the things that we always sort of ask everyone when they come on the show is if they have specific words of wisdom or advice that they might be able to give to someone who's just getting started in the industry, what would be like the nuggets that you would share with them to kind of let them accelerate their career?
I will lead with you're not your customer. And so once you accept that you're not the person who's going to use your software, don't guess and don't ask them because they lie. Right. You've got to build tests. You've got to build scenarios where you can watch the customer's behavior. Become David Attenborough. And here we see the wild user trying to solve a problem. And collect real data. You know, you want to be successful in your job, build the stuff that people actually want to use. And the best way to do that is to not think you know, to actually go collect facts about what people actually use, what they care about, how they want to work. And, you'll go a long way.
Awesome.
The technical skill is never going to save you.
Yeah.
Actually knowing the right thing to build to provide real value to people, that will always save you.
Excellent. Excellent. Obviously, there's people can find you at your podcast there, .NET Rocks. What other social media plugs can you give?
Rich Campbell is my Twitter handle, and you'll see me there a lot. I certainly tweet out about it every show I'm making and those sorts of things. The conference is Dev Intersection. Next one coming up is first week of December. We'll be in Las Vegas at the MGM Grand, and that should be a very interesting show. I'm involved in a new show. This is only second year we've done it, which is second week of October in Orlando. That is Angular Mix. So Angular to me felt like it crossed that threshold now where the regular enterprise developers are really jumping on it. And so it's less of the open source digerati types and more of mainstream devs that just want to get stuff done. And this is a tool they can use reliably. And so that's what Angular Mix is about.
Is there any new work on the humanitarian toolbox?
Yeah, the HTBox is going really well. We have a couple of interesting projects on the go right now. Already, of course, is sort of our flagship, helping organize volunteers and using their time efficiently, using a little mobile with the back end and integration with social media. The EnvoAd project, we call the Crisis Check-In, has gone through some interesting testing lately. It's very challenging to integrate with the NGOs, the professional responders. Their bar is extremely high, and it should be. It's not a bad thing. They say terrible things to us, like, how does this beat pen and paper? Because I really like the battery life of paper. But we've been going through some tests with them and getting some good results. So everything's on GitHub, github.com/HTBox. There's a number of different projects going there. Rocky Lotka has been leading a project specifically around missing kids. That is also, we're the repository, the sort of home base for that one too. So you can dig into that. And there's lots of work items sitting there that are sort of jump ins. So if you're new to open source or you just want to get started with stuff, we can always use your help.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you, Richard. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Always a pleasure, guys. That was good fun.
That was Richard Campbell. Richard wrote his first line of code in 1977 and still isn't over it. He's had a bunch of jobs in computing, built a few companies along the way, and these days does a little consulting, makes a podcast, .NET Rocks and Run As Radio, is one of the folks behind the Dev Intersection conferences, as well as being chief cheerleader for the charity Humanitarian Toolbox.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.